Welcome to the Merlin Podcast, bringing Europe's fresh waters back to life.
When we see the ability of the river to restore itself once we give it the proper conditions, it's amazing the force of resilience in nature, you know, the force of the ability to restore. And I think we can learn from that, and I think we can, you know, connect to that and to our own ability to restore our relationships.
The voice you just heard is Tal Marciano Ratnes. Tal works for the Ministry of Agriculture and Food Security in Israel and is telling me about the pioneering work she's organising around the restoration of the Sipori River in the north of the country. As you'll hear, for Tal, the restoration of the river offers a meeting place for people from different religions and ethnicities to come together in community in a time of great unrest and conflict. I'm Rob St. John, and throughout this podcast we'll hear stories of why community is just so vital to freshwater restoration and how the public can actively support restoration activities. We'll hear about dam removal, citizen science, angling clubs and community-led initiatives. But let's start by hearing more from Tal, telling us about her work along the Sipori River, supported by the Merlin Project.
This is a very unique country with our diverse communities and our challenges. And also, we have a very unique program. The restoration of the Sipori watershed is in a watershed scale. You know, it doesn't happen usually. And it's actually a very important ecological corridor that connects the Mediterranean Sea to the Sea of Galilee, the Kinneret. The only ecological corridor that connects these two very important places. So this is part of our work, you know, to create this flow to enable the water and the biota, this space between these two places. So we really have the opportunity to do many things and to think outside the box and create really an impact on the whole watershed and the different communities that live in it. Tsipori started the Nazareth area upstream, and after 32 kilometers, it reaches the Haifa Bay, very close to the Mediterranean Sea. It's an area of diverse communities. We have cities upstream, Nazareth and its area. It's like a metropolitan. And downstream, Haifa and the area, another metropolitan. And between these two metropolitans, we have a very peaceful, serene agricultural area with small villages. We have villages of communities from Arab origins and from Jewish origins. We have kibbutzim. And we have community villages, communal villages, and we have Bedouins, and we have Muslims. We have all sorts. And I think it's part of the assets of this area, because it's really diverse, and each community brings something very special to the common area. And we try to work with these forces, not as we don't look at it as a place for conflict, though there are conflicts, many conflicts between people and between people and the environment. But we really try to create the connections between people and between people and the environment. And from that to grow, to create something that is strong and unique and diverse. And, you know, like in nature, once you have diversity, you are stronger. So we work with that, with the force of nature and with the force of society to create healing processes, especially in the time we're in Israel. So we really engage in empowering and cultivate local activists and leaders. And so they will be the ambassadors of the river in their own communities. And we have many programs to train community leaders to work and to create a network of connections that will really help them to cope with everything that they're in. And we also, because of the diverse communities, as I said, we see it as a force. So we really work on creating a common area for everyone, place that people will feel that they're connected to. It's their own. It's connected to their identity. And it also a place to meet the neighbors, to meet someone else that perhaps you don't know in everyday life, but you have the opportunity to meet in a wonderful place in the river. So we also, as I said, we encourage public engagement, and we work with the people in order to take them outside of their own communities and meet together in the common area. And also, we know that in times of in bad times, in times that we deal with many difficult things, actually, I think as Israelis, we are all in kind of a collective trauma, ongoing trauma, with so many aspects in it. The nature can heal. The nature can help us to restore our ability to cope and to work together for a better future for us and for our neighbors. Though we are, you know, a regional entity, when we work in a watershed, I think the impact, if we create something good that connects people, you know, Jews and Arabs and different communities, the circles of good and trust can widen. And perhaps in the future, we can hope for, you know, peace with our neighbors once we have peace amongst ourselves.
Tal and her team have organized a series of community festivals and creative workshops to help bring different communities together through the restoration of the Sipori.
So we have a program that is called Circles of Resilience. In it, we try to create places in the environment as part of placemaking, creating places that are important to people, that are not only physical places, also places that people feel that they're attached to. And in these places, in order to help people get outside, we also create workshops in different themes or different subjects. People will have writing workshops or storytelling workshops, and so on. And also we talk about language coffee, where Arabs and Jews can come and speak in Arabic and Hebrew together and learn the languages and just be with their neighbors and feel comfortable, you know, drink coffee together, talk about everything that is going on and how we feel about it, and connect, really connect through the, you know, the language is part of our culture, and understanding each other's language is part of understanding the other. So really, we think about the area of the watershed in different aspects and different ways in order to create these connections between people and between the people and nature. We have created a festival with an entity that works with Arabs and Jews and classical music, that looks at music as something that connects people and cultures and so on. So we have created a music festival with them, with classical music and both traditional music in Hebrew and in Arabic. And we understood that people need that. People need something to allow them to rest from the tension, to connect to the nature and connect to each other. So we have created concerts in nature, very close to the river. And many people have come. And it was so beautiful. As I told you before, you know, Hebrew and Arabic are so similar. The music is so similar. Our culture is so similar. And when we were together with people who sang in both languages, you could feel like it's part of something that is whole, you know. We are all part of something that is one. And it was very powerful for people to feel that. We also had our instructors that went with people and told them about the alongside the river and told them about the restoration and about our work and about the the work of the different communities in the area. So people could really learn more, and they can engage more if they want to.
Placemaking, in Tal's terms, has multiple meanings. On one hand, we could think of it as the restoration of the river's ecosystems after decades of pollution and water scarcity. But, crucially, it's also about people and their relationships to the river and each other.
We really look at the area of the river as a place that connects people from different communities. So this is something that we have really created with the different stakeholders. And now they meet in different groups, people from these two villages each week. And they talk about different things and they enjoy nature together. And it's just one example that when we work with the communities and with the local authorities and with the one who is in charge of the area of not only the river, but the wide area, we can create such an activity that really creates a place. These people that engage in this activity know that there's a specific place that is not in the inside the villages. It's outside. It's close to the river. It's inside the forest, that they can just be together and together enjoy all the different resources of the nature and the communities. We need to have hope for our country, for our people, for our area, you know, for all the people that are part of this area. And this work, I think it creates hope, and it creates something to look for in the future. And it helps us strengthen the communities and their ability to cope with everything.
Tal's story suggests that even in times of significant unrest and conflict, fostering community connections around a river can offer beacons of hope, not only for nature, but for people too. Our interviews were recorded over the summer of 2024, before the conflict between Israel and Hezbollah in Lebanon, not far from where Tal lives and works, escalated. Tal sent me an email in October 2024 as I began to edit this podcast. She writes, "It's not easy for those living in the northern part of the country, and we continue to maintain connections with the various communities and create a space for shared dialogue, emotional release, and hope. Just before the escalation of the operation in Lebanon, we organised a meeting of community leaders who'd completed a watershed leadership course through the Sipori project. This was the first meeting with the community as part of a placemaking project around the concrete passages under the roads along the river. The group, which included representatives from various communities along the river, shared their experiences and dreams related to the desire to create a change in awareness regarding the importance of the river and the connections between people as part of a shared space. For our next story, we move to the growing topic of dam removal. Removing dams, weirs, and other obstacles from rivers has become increasingly popular over recent decades, as environmental managers seek to restore free-flowing waterways which allow migratory species like salmon and eels to move freely. This practice is likely to only grow in the future, as the recently adopted EU Nature Restoration Law seeks to restore 25,000 kilometres of free-flowing rivers across the continent in the coming years. As Ruben Rocha, Project Manager for Dam Removal Europe, explains, working with communities around a dam removal project is vital.
Dam removal is not a very sexy topic. When you talk about dam removal, people don't understand it. They will feel that we are destroying something that is providing water for them. And they feel insecure in some situations. But it's really hard to communicate this kind of project. But in any case, when we implement this kind of projects in different countries, we try to approach communities to raise awareness, show them the impact, the positive impacts of these removals, and how they can benefit from this. And in some situations we succeed, in others we still have works to do. And it's something that will never change. But in any case, it's just awareness raising and providing scientific information in the most simple way that we can do it. Personally, one of the projects I was managing in Portugal was to remove an obsolete weir in the south region, in the Adelaide stream. This stream is located in a very small community, near a very small community, with around 8 people living in that place. And at the beginning, when we presented the project, it was okay. We had very few attending the public session to present the project, but we had some people against the project, but it was fine. But when we started doing the work, this is where all the noise started. We had publications on Facebook saying that we were causing damage to the river, we were polluting the river because of the work we were removing a weir. So it's normal to have some impacts in the beginning when you are doing this kind of work. But us with our partners, we talked and tried to mobilize the social media to show the positive impact that this project could bring. We've prepared tools that could be provided to communities to understand the benefits, and we invited them to visit the site. And right now, the weir is not there anymore.
As Ruben suggests, there can be multiple conflicting opinions about dam removal projects in the communities which are affected by them. As Ruben says, a big part of his community work is telling stories about the positive impacts dam removal can have, both for people and for nature. However, the rapid transmission of information across social media can make this communication process tricky.
At the foundation, we had a lot of situations where people were against the removals. We had situations in France. We have situations nowadays in Spain where we have the Vox party trying to stop some of the removals, arguing that we are destroying source of water that could be used by communities, using fake news in most of these videos that they are publishing in TikTok and other social media. It is definitely difficult because when people use misinformation, that when they use fake news, it's really easy to provide this kind of information in Facebook, in Instagram, and people will buy it because this is what they are seeing. And most of the times, NGOs and environmental organizations, they don't have the same engagement in social media to respond to these questions. And they don't have the capacity to respond to everyone. For long, NGOs talk about the benefits to nature, and now we are understanding that we also have to put people in the story. We have to show the benefits that the restoration projects in general, not only dam removal, provide to people. And this is what we are trying to do now. We are preparing fact sheets and documents where we can show what are the benefits that people will get from these restoration projects. And one of them is the response for climate change impact. We will help river flow in a natural way. These will recharge the aquifers. These will provide sediments and nutrients to agriculture fields. So this will provide water, fresh water with higher quality. We will reduce the temperature of the river because this river is not dammed anymore. So the temperature will reduce. There is a lot of benefits to people that could be shared, and we are trying to share this in our social media, in our websites, and with documents that we give to people, and focusing on people right now, because we have to understand that people is part of nature.
As is so often the case in restoration projects, we encounter the idea of shifting baseline syndrome, where people only really understand the environment they've known as its natural state, even if it was radically different only a generation or two before.
It is a control matter. It is something that people see as That's normal. We've channelized almost all of our rivers. We have very few free flow rivers in Europe. When they were born, they saw a brick of wall and concrete somewhere. They think that that's the way that the river is supposed to be. They have this kind of historical attachment, and they have the fear of not having water available in the future. And this fear of not having water is used in many cases when people are against dam removals, because they see dams as a water provider. And in fact, it's not a water provider. It's just a box that you are holding water that is supposed to have his normal cycle. And it's really hard to change the mentality when people has this historical attachments to things that they are used to see. It's the way that they saw it for 50, 60, 70 years. And it takes time to change that mentality. And sometimes we cannot do it. So we have to convince the young generations to do it for us. They are the ones that will have to face the impact of climate change in 20, 50 years. So they have to be the ones doing it for the NGOs when we cannot reach the older generation. There is definitely people that were there before the dam was constructed. And in these cases, we can use these people to share the stories. They could fish different kind of fishes because the river were free flowing. They could swim in a much better river because the river were free flowing. They could see the river going. They could see the seasonal fluctuation in the river, and after the construction of the dam, they only see a reservoir, and that's it. It's a very big lake where some of them goes in summer, but they lose the connectivity with nature.
Ruben suggests that whilst much of his work involves highlighting the benefits of dam removal to communities, he's beginning to see the demand for removal projects coming from the communities themselves.
One of the projects that is going on right now in Portugal, led by WWF, is a removal of a small weir that we only found this weir because the owner of this of the land that where this river stream is contacted WWF to remove that weir because it's useless. It's there for long. It blocks fish migration. There is a lot of native and endangered species there that needs a free flow river to reproduce, but they cannot because the river is dammed. So the owner contacted us to remove it, and now there is a project going on to remove this weir. So there are a lot of stories where people contact us to do this kind of project because they want to see the fish going back to the river. They want to see the river flowing, free flowing again.
I ask Ruben, what's he learned from his work engaging communities in dam restoration across Europe?
What I've learned is that removing dams is something that requires a crazy person to start, and then you need a lot of other crazy people to join you and build the movement. I've learned that we need to do more. We need to communicate more. We need to engage much more communities to be part of these projects. Most of the time, we just involve the community when the project is already designed, and we go there to implement them. And we need to bring people to be part of the designing of the application, to understand the reasons behind the construction, and then understand and then show them why we have to remove it.
Through placemaking and community engagement, Tal and Ruben's stories highlight the value of involving people in river restoration projects from an early stage. In our next story, we'll hear similar themes, exploring how people can actively help scientists research and monitor freshwaters in a process known as citizen science. Roland Bischoff and Julia van Gonne are researchers from the IDIV Centre in Germany. Roland and Julia have been working to train up citizen scientists to help monitor German streams through the Flow project. As they explain, this is vital in helping fill the gaps in our understanding of stream ecology and how streams are managed under the EU's big freshwater policy, the Water Framework Directive. Here's Julia.
The Water Framework Directive is mainly monitoring the big streams and rivers, so the bigger rivers, and actually the small streams are not really covered, and the really small streams which have catchment areas below 10 square kilometers. And with citizen science, we want to fill this gap. So we want to motivate people to learn how to observe their streams in a standardized way, to look at them in a more systematic way. Because often if you, for example, take a walk at your favorite stream and you look at it, you might think that it's actually going well, that it's there are some trees, some animals around, maybe there are birds. And you might think, oh, well, this stream could be quite healthy. But then if you look at it in a more systematic way, you discover that many streams are actually heavily modified. And with the Flow Project, we want to pass on some of our enthusiasm for this ecosystem. And we want to exchange with citizens and also empower them to look at their streams in a more systematic way. And therefore, we developed protocols which are really closely aligned to the Water Framework Directive standards, so that we really reach this goal of collecting scientific data, which can also be published and used in studies to inform freshwater protection. They really want to learn and discover about streams and also want to network among themselves, because it's really helpful also to meet other people who are also interested and engaged and want to take action in the freshwater area. But then our main driver and motivation is to collect data that can help scientists and agencies to change the actual poor health of streams.
As Roland explains, citizen science is growing across the continent.
What's really worth doing this concept of citizen science monitoring is that there's a network growing, and time by time, now we have already around 100 groups, this year more than 70 groups participating. And this is such a big treasure for science. It wouldn't be possible only for scientists to collect that many data. It is as well already shown in the past years that the data, for example, of macrosorbentos or macroinvertebrate sampling, they are quite reliable up to family level. So yeah, we can trust the data, and Julia can go on with that.
Yeah, so that was really important for us to show and also to study how accurate are the citizen science data, because there's also many skeptical voices who saying, well, lay people who haven't studied this or who have no training won't be able to identify invertebrates or won't be able to assess streams in a standardized manner. And then so to look at this, we in 2021 we sampled 30 streams with flow groups, and in parallel we sampled those streams with professional scientists, and we compared the results to have a really detailed overview of how good the citizen science data actually are. And so we found that as Roland mentioned, if the citizen scientists are trained and well prepared, they can actually, also with our learning material, the identification booklet we provided, they can identify benthic invertebrates to family level. So the rate of correct identification was about 90%.
As Julia and Roland suggest, the public can help collect reliable and accurate data about freshwater ecosystems through their citizen science programs. I asked what effects this process can have on how people use and value their streams and rivers. Here's Roland.
I suppose that it depends from site to site, the constitution of the people who are there and who take care or who are interested in the small streams. They are curious and they want to know more about what's going on there. They take care if there's litter around, they collect it. And and they are very curious as well when we make this kind of monitorings, and what at the end what turns out we we find quite biodiverse communities, and they didn't expect that. They sometimes can't believe that in a small stream there's even fish swimming, or there's so many little creatures around. And that's really cool. It's an education process, and people get empowered and get trained. And at after several years, we notice that they get little experts. They are learning quite a lot of what's going on in their stream.
In some cases, Roland and Yulia have found that through citizen science, the public have become empowered to actively get involved in the conservation and restoration of their local freshwaters.
What we are doing now is starting with those trained groups who are already in contact to their municipalities and, for example, to associations which take care for the maintenance of these small streams, and for the landowners, because it's not so easy. You can't start. And at least in Germany, everything needs a plan, and you need to ask people for permissions. And that's we give those groups who are willing to get deeper and to start restoration, we give them a little bit help. What checklist should they follow? Which kind of tasks they shouldn't forget about?
For Julia, this theme is important. Citizen science can offer people the chance to have a say in how the environment is managed and to find communities who think similarly.
Yeah, my motivation for citizen science and also what I experience is that many people feel so helpless and frustrated because of all the global environmental crisis. Especially as an individual, if you want to change, it's really, you can change your individual lifestyle, but you can't change the system on your own. So you need a community, a collective to network and also to help each other and really to get things moving. And there, I think citizen science can help a lot because it combines this willingness of people to engage and to exchange, and but also their curiosity and their willingness to contribute to science. And this is really, for me and also for the people I worked with, I think, this really gives us a lot of energy to know that we can collect data that can have an impact. So we can have an impact together with lots of people who are interested and motivated to look at their streams and to observe what is going on in their environment. And what I've learned is how important networking is. So identifying and talking to the right people who are connected to different communities. So also bringing together different communities like the environmental NGOs who have a lot of experience and knowledge, and also in policy work with the anglers, for example, who sometimes can have different goals and prejudices maybe against each other, but then if they work together on this project, they realize, well, no, actually we often have the same goals, and this is also so rewarding from my point of view to join up forces and all work for freshwater monitoring and restoration together.
And these networks of people and organizations advocating for freshwaters can be powerful, as Roland states.
What I have learned is that we need these multiplicators, which can be scientists, but even it can be people, just enthusiastic people around who are already doing, for example, practical work for decades. And with these kind of citizen science approach, they sometimes even get now a voice, and they can actually strengthen their communities. And they can make their data visible. Before, some of them, they already collected data. They are little experts. No one knows about it. The data are just there in a box. And now they are recorded. We have this kind of data management where we can structure and collect data in an organized way. And I think that's great.
Roland and Yulia's story highlights how communities can create valuable knowledge about freshwater ecosystems and, in so doing, offer vital support for their restoration. Yulia's point about the need to bring people together to find common goals resonates with our next story about the value of engaging angling communities in restoration projects. Robert Arlinghouse's work has long explored this subject. As a scientist from the Leibniz Institute of Freshwater Ecology and Inland Fisheries and Humboldt University in Berlin, Germany, writes in his biography, "I like fish and I like fishing, and I like to study fish, fishers and fishing." Here's Robert to explain how recreational anglers have had influence on freshwater ecosystems for decades.
I mean, usually people, if they think about fisheries, they think about marine fisheries, they think about industrialized fisheries, big trawlers, and of course all of that exists. But in the industrialized nations, the key player in terms of harvesting and using wild fish stocks and freshwater systems are actually recreational fishermen or fishers. And mostly this is angling. So it's essentially things that you do during recreation. You go out, you know, after work, you go fishing. You harvest fish and so on. And in Central Europe, in the UK, also most of these anglers are organized in angling clubs, and in this position they also have rights to harvest and to use freshwater systems, the fish stocks they're in, and they usually also have a management obligation, which is codified in law. So they are users and managers of local fisheries, and this makes them so interesting academically because, yeah, they are not just harvesting and using a resource, but they're also managing it. And you might have several pathways by which they can also influence freshwater systems and fish stocks. The most obvious one is by introducing fish. This, in the beginning of the 20th century, was done on purpose. You know, you introduce new species, for example, in North America, to enrich your local community. So it was seen as best practice. This has changed. So nowadays, the introductions are, at least in Germany, prohibited and also don't take place, at least not within the legal framework. But this has definitely affected fish communities across the world. I mean, for example, British colonial times, there was lots of introductions in India, in Australia, and so on. So yes, those species have an impact. And finally, of course, recreation anglers alter fish stocks. If they harvest them, they reduce the biomass. They usually alter the size and age structure. This can cause issues. And also the presence at the waterside can, of course, disturb habitats, plants, birds, and so on.
Across Europe, angling communities are often organised into clubs, which manage rivers and lakes, which led Robert to begin studying their interactions with the environment.
As I told you, most of the angler communities are organised in clubs. They have a management right, and in that function, they of course also work for nature conservation and biodiversity conservation. So most of these communities do well-intended actions that they also without scientific involvement. So they basically restore habitats. They politically lobby, for example, against pollution and for removal of migration barriers and so on. So they do that. Now, a few of those actions are quite controversial. For example, the stocking of fish, which is a very common management practice, is quite controversial. So at some point, I decided that I want to do these more involved projects where I actually work together with the angler communities and to do experiments together. So essentially sorting out some of those uncertainties, because also these angler communities, for example, in relation to stocking, they do have an uncertainty whether it works or not. So we actually teamed with a large set of angler communities, designed stocking experiments in one huge project. In another one, we added also habitat restoration activities. This was done in lakes, where the shorelines of, in this case, artificial gravel pit lakes, very important type of water that is used for recreational fishing, were actually improved in terms of the habitat structure and quality in close cooperation with the angling clubs. It was their waters, so they essentially financed some of this. They invested their own time, free time, and so on to organize big restoration activities and creation of shallow water zones, for example, which meant heavy work and getting, you know, sand out of the water and planting it and so on. So we did this together, but we as scientists then monitored the results and fed the results back in regular workshop settings to the angler community so they can really witness what worked and what did not. And this has clearly changed a lot of future practices. So, for example, many of the stocking exercises were found to be inefficient. And I know that many of the clubs have then stopped or altered those practices. And in the habitat enhancement, we could show that the creation of these shallow water zones was extremely effective, very sustainable, increased the fish stocks, but also other taxa. And this now you see many angling clubs picking up and implementing this also without our assistance, because we also do a lot of public outreach and science communication. So this is really out in the community and it's spreading.
So, as Robert explains, whilst angling clubs are inevitably going to undertake management activities that prioritise fish stocks, through engaging with them, it's possible to highlight how their actions can benefit the wider ecosystem. Robert's work with anglers shares a kinship with Tal's notion of placemaking around a river. That is, by spending significant time around fresh waters, communities can become more attentive to their ecological shifts and knowledgeable about their needs for their stewardship.
Absolutely. Yeah, we call this potential aquatic stewardship, and we have a few papers that outlines that concept in more detail. So the basic idea of the high aquatic stewardship potential of recreation fishing communities emerges from various levels, but it starts at the experience level. I mean, these are highly involved people that, of course, use nature. I mean, they kill fish and they use them and eat them and so on. But this, of course, also does something to you. I mean, you kind of embed yourself in a natural food web. If you're conscious about what you do, you also realize the outputs of your actions. So you kind of learn what it means, let's say, to kill a fish and that it's no longer there. And if you kill too many, the fish stocks will change. If you interact for a long time, which usually these anglers do, maybe they start as a youngster and then fish lifelong, they also witness environmental change that is not caused by recreation fishing, let's say the effects of damming or warming or pollution. And so they get these experiences that are very important to build, let's say, to build a conscious mind about your ecological role. And of course, this does not hold for everybody. There will always be some that don't and so on, but some become very involved and therefore have a high, what we call aquatic stewardship potential. And I think in some cases, it's untapped and could be used more for also broader restoration action. And I do think the recreation fishing clubs have kind of lost that role over time. There are very good examples in the UK, for example, that early angler associations were actually the primary environmental and non-governmental organization, kind of fighting against pollution, let's say in the 19th century or early 20th century, particularly. You get that idealized form of stewardship if you involve yourself, you immerse yourself, you move slowly in the landscape, you learn about the impacts of your action, which is often very place-based. So it's localities to which you have a connection. You know, we tend to think of indigenous communities as the parallel, but we see exactly the same in recreation fishing groups.
Robert highlights the untapped potential of involving angling groups in helping support restoration projects, but cautions the need for background knowledge and open communication in helping foster collaborations between them and scientists.
You know, I come from the angling culture, so that's very important. You know, they will be suspicious typically of an alien person, let's say from an animal welfare group, they would be not so eager to collaborate with. And I come from the angling culture, so over many years, I think I have a certain level of trust in that community, which helps as a door opener. And what you then have to really do, and that I think not many environmental scientists are willing to do, is you have to, you know, involve yourself. As a scientist, you have to go to the meetings, you have to engage in face-to-face interactions. You know, what we do, we are social creatures. We sit around a coffee table and we talk through things. We are scientists. We do things with a certain methodological background. Your practical knowledge is equally valuable. You might even know much more than us, but we both want to learn together. And that is the kind of vibe you have to bring into the cooperation. That doesn't mean you should stand away from scientific standards, not at all. But it's a way of how you kind of approach the stakeholders. Yeah, not with a ready-made answer, and you don't want to teach them about anything. You want to learn together. And this has worked for us immensely. So we get a high buy-in also by the ordinary club members. Not all of them like us, of course. There will always be people suspicious of science. But on average, we have had very good experiences in such environments.
With this in mind, I ask Robert for his key lessons for scientists seeking to work with angling communities. First, he highlights a key tension in potential collaborations with angling communities, the perception that an ecosystem might not be available for anglers to use in the same way once it's restored.
We call it blue fear. It's the fear that once your system is restored, then suddenly, like, this rare species is detected and they say, now you cannot access it anymore. And I think that's at the core of all of those stakeholder conflicts you have. Of course, for them, it's a threat. If they perceive, you know, the first steps as something that could end in them being kicked out of the wetland or losing access to it or stuff like this. So you might even end there, but this decision should come out of the interaction, with the stakeholder. It should not be predetermined. And I think that would be a big lesson I would give to people. It's something where you find out the joint interests, where nothing is predetermined, and where the ultimate tools or things that are done are something that is decided by the group, you know, ideally with consensus. And this means you have to take your time to build the relationship and the trust and to bring people together and work together. And this is nothing you do in one workshop setting. It just takes a lot of resources and time. It is resource intensive. So that's the second lesson. Don't do these things if you are time constrained and resource constrained. You are predetermined what you want to do. So your values kind of determine what should come out that people will sense, and the cooperation will break down very quickly or not develop at all. Expect you will not be loved by all. There will be interest conflicts. Depends on how, you know, whether you know, the livelihood or if a company is affected, then the things are maybe more heated than if it's just recreation. But you will not make everybody happy. There will be conflicts. You have to live with those. You have to kind of deal with them in a professional way. In all of our projects, we had those. I would say work with anglers because they are a group. There are others, but they're a group that deeply, deeply care about freshwater systems, about the creatures they're in. Of course, they care most about fish, but they deeply care about biodiversity and restoration. They know that many things went wrong through habitat degradation and so on. So they become big players and supporters for restoration activities. But of course, they also care about their recreational activities. So you need to be very sensitive in terms of the future use, and this should not be at stake, because otherwise they would simply not become your friends.
So far, we've heard from scientists and project managers who've sought to engage the communities around the freshwaters they restore. But, as we've heard in different ways, from Ruben, Yulia and Robert, restoration projects can often be community-led. To find out more about such initiatives, I spoke to Maria Sanchez from ECHOLEES, the European Network for Community-Led Initiatives on Climate Change and Sustainability. Maria and her colleagues seek to support community-led initiatives across Europe. Here she is to explain.
Community-led initiatives is a very wide term. It's basically self-organized initiatives of people working together on an ongoing basis towards some environmental and social goals, usually within the same place. But it could go from transition movements to energy cooperatives to community supported agriculture to ecosystem restoration camps, ecovillages. So it's really broad, and it would be very difficult to actually map how many community-led initiatives exist, not only in Europe, but in the whole world, right? What ECHOLEES tries to do with community-led initiatives is to raise awareness and to raise the profile of community-led initiatives. We have four main domains, which are advocate, enable, inspire, and learn. And through those domains, we work with community-led initiatives with different angles. So the enable domain, it's more about networking, about, you know, creating stronger relationships with different groups and with different networks. So ECHOLEES works kind of like a meta network of a network of networks within Europe. but also in the advocate domain, the purpose is more to have an impact at policy level and be able to communicate to policymakers which are the needs of community-led initiatives, but also what's their contribution to the goals that they are actually trying to reach. And then in Inspire, which is more of the communications domain where I work, in Inspire, we try to tell stories, to communicate on social media, to create videos, to share resources from our members and from Ecolis, from the different projects where we are also working with EU-funded projects or with private donors. And then the learn domain is more about maybe more academic research, contact with scientists and trying to build. It's kind of like a domain that's we are trying to restore a little bit now. But those are the main areas where Ecolis is working.
Like all our interviewees so far, Maria highlights the value that including local communities in discussions over environmental management can have.
I feel that probably scientists are every day surprised of how people with no academic background come up with ideas that are innovative, that are socially and ecologically innovative. And I feel that if we would be able to inspire others, you know, to inspire policymakers, we tend many times to diminish the work of policymakers. And I think all of them are agents of change. And if we would be able to create these conversations and dialogues in a participatory way, that would be key.
Maria's idea of agents of change captures this community-led, bottom-up approach to environmental management. She gives the example of the Sunseed Desert Technology Community in Spain, where water scarcity has shaped how the community has formed and operates.
I think 36 years ago, there were these British scientists that came to the south of Spain to research about desertification. And they thought, well, desertification is going to be a problem in Europe, and we need to see what can be done. And we need to experiment and see how can we battle desertification. And they settled in Almería, next to the Desierto de Tabernas, to start researching and putting in practice some techniques. They do an annual festival called Festival del Agua, which means the Festival of Water. And they do, you know, like little workshops on drylands restoration or on wastewater systems, or they do tours around the village so that people can see with their own eyes how they function, because it's off the grid as well. Water is so important in Sunseed because there is the Rio Aguas, the waters, it's called Waters River. and it's one of the if not the only river in Almería that has permanent flow of water. But the aquifer is emptying because of intensive agriculture and monoculture of olive trees, basically. There is a risk that this river will actually dry up. I was very, very shocked, for example, when I you know, traveled around the area, and I learned about the Mar de Plástico, which is the sea of plastic. And there's this huge plot of land filled with greenhouse, but put with like these plastics on the to cover the fields. And Almería, which is one of the driest areas in Europe, it's actually the garden of Europe. So they provide vegetables and fruit to Europeans, you know, in the north of Europe. And I'm like, how come, you know, that there's this lack of water, this scarcity of water? Then you realize, you know, like there is an exploitation really of the soil.
Maria has spent time living at Sunseed, where nature-based solutions like natural water filtration systems and water-friendly farming approaches are used amid a swathe of intensively farmed olive plantations.
And then when you start learning about the degradation of the soil and how it changes the cycles, and then there's these heavy rainfalls coming and moving the fertile layer of the soil, and then not allowing for water retention, you know, and not to talk about pesticides, and you know, so then when you see that and you live in this little paradise called Sunseed where there's this natural pool and it sounds everything very, very beautiful and bucolic, and then you're like, well, actually, I think one of the problems is that sometimes we need to see it with our own eyes. And I've been told about this change of mentality from the locals in Sorbas, which is the closest village to Sunseed. At the beginning, kind of like, ah, this is not true. There's always been water on this river, you know, like we've always been able to go and have a swim in that natural pool. And then that's why this education is so important, you know, and then maybe having a look at other areas that are connected so that you can make the links and be like, okay, yeah, it doesn't make sense, you know, and then you start understanding. And I think this is the beauty of it as well.
This is a theme we've heard in different ways throughout this podcast. When people learn a little bit more about their local environment, they're likely to become a little bit more connected and embedded in it, and are more likely to care for it. In Tal's story, we heard how placemaking along the restored Sipori River is providing vital spaces for cross-cultural connection in a time of conflict and unrest. From Ruben, we heard about the challenges of telling stories over why dam removal is important and the benefits it can bring to communities, whilst at the same time encountering the growing trend of communities across Europe advocating for their dams to be removed. From Roland and Julia, we heard how citizen science can empower the public and deepen their connections with waterways, whilst at the same time generating valuable data for scientists. Robert highlighted the value of scientists engaging with communities like anglers, who are deeply connected with freshwaters, but emphasised that care must be taken in how such collaborations are carried out. And finally, Maria offered an overarching view of community-led initiatives across Europe, highlighting how projects like Sunseed can offer beacons of sustainable environmental management, even in highly stressed landscapes. I think we can all take lessons from the stories we've heard in this podcast. If nothing else, they remind me that restoring fresh waters is always as much about people as it is about nature. You can find out more about the Merlin Project at project-merlin.eu. You can also keep up with our progress on social media and at freshwaterblog.net. The Merlin Project is funded by the European Commission's Horizon 2020 programme. This podcast was presented and produced by me, Rob St. John, and the theme music is by project coordinator Sebastian Burke's band, Scala. The background music is by Scott Buckley. Please do like, share and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And until next time, thanks for tuning in.